Welcome to In the Spotlight. I'm Abigail Pogrebin. Samuel G. Friedman is an award-winning professor, columnist, and author of 10 acclaimed books. As a staff reporter for the New York Times, he wrote the paper's On Education column, winning first prize in the Education Writers Association's annual competition in 2005. From 2006 through 2016, Friedman wrote the On Religion column, receiving the Gold Zire Prize for Journalists in 2017 for a series of columns about Muslim Americans. As a professor of journalism at Columbia University, he has been named the nation's outstanding journalism educator by the Society of Professional Journalists, and he's received Columbia's coveted Presidential Award for Outstanding Teaching. His most recent book, Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights, was published this past summer, 2023. Welcome, Sam, to the broadcast. I can call you Sam because I've known you a number of years, and I've had the privilege of watching you teach, and you are a master educator. So
thank you so much. Now, if I can call you Abby out of our long-time friendship.
You can, for now.
Okay.
Let's talk about this book, because Hubert Humphrey is not the most obvious central figure in American history and politics. You make him come alive, I think, in ways I personally didn't expect. Why did you decide to write about him?
Well, I've set out to fill a biographical gap, but also a historical gap. The biographical gap is that if people knew anything about Humphrey these days, it was from this discredited latter part of his political career when he supported the Vietnam War as Lyndon Johnson's vice president, had a failed run for the presidency in 1968, a failed run against the peace candidate George McGovern for the Democratic nomination in 1972.
So he's a little bit of a laughingstock.
He was an object of ridicule. On the college campuses, like the one I went to, we were all reading Rolling Stone when Hunter S. Thompson notoriously wrote that Humphrey campaigned like a rat in heat, that kind of frenetic, desperate quality at the end of his political career. But there was this amazing earlier chapter in his life, particularly in the 1940s, when he was the very, very, very rare white Christian who was totally engaged in the battles against racism and anti-Semitism in this country, two battles that were very closely related. And then the historical gap was that civil rights movement of the 1940s that really makes possible everything we think of incorrectly as the beginning of civil rights activity, with Brown versus Board of Ed, decision outlawing school segregation, and Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 and on through the freedom rides and lunch counter sit-ins and so on. So I wanted to write a book that could address both of those things.
The fact that he was an unlikely white Christian, as you said, growing up in South Dakota, who suddenly seems to care, not a little bit, but almost obsessively, with a sense of justice, civil rights for Jewish Americans, anti-Semitism. What made him, what was the crucible of his childhood that even led to that focus in his life?
Well, Humphrey had a father who, part of him was like Harold Hill in The Music Man, a little bit of a small town con man, almost running the local drugstore and a bit of a fabulist about what he could accomplish. But the father, H.H., was also really idealistic. He was a liberal Democrat in a town full of conservative Republicans. He was an agnostic in a town full of churchgoers. And he began to build up Hubert Humphrey's really education in idealism. But Humphrey really was kind of a standard issue, New Deal, economics-oriented Democrat. Nothing wrong with that, but it's limited until age 28 in 1939 when he goes to grad school at Louisiana State University.
Before we get to Louisiana State, I just want to stay with the father for a second.
Sure.
Because he was an atheist.
Right.
But then he kind of, I don't want to, radicalized is the wrong idea, but he's maybe kind of transformed by a reverend.
Right. H.H.'s best friend is the new Methodist minister in their tiny little town of Dolan, South Dakota, a minister named Albert Hart. And this is important because Albert Hart was part of what was called the social gospel movement. And the social gospel Protestants didn't think that the whole goal of being an observant Protestant was just to not drink and not dance and, you know, be sexually pure till marriage and try to go to heaven. It's not that they disagreed with those stances, but what they talked about was creating what they called the kingdom of God on earth. And for them, that meant social action. Their idea of being a good Protestant was you should support the labor movement. You should reach out to people in other religions. You should reach out to Black Americans. And that theology, the social gospel, was really essential to Humphrey's development. And his kind of deep religious belief, which by the way included a deep understanding of the Hebrew Bible, and particularly the social justice prophets, is absolutely integral to who he is politically.
And then also before he gets to LSU, there's a depression before we even think about the depression, right? And tell us how that affected just his worldview, the fact that his father lost his drugstore and he suddenly was scrambling.
Right. Basically what happens is that the whole economy of the Dakotas is based on selling wheat. And wheat prices, for a variety of reasons, plummet in the early 1920s. And farmers can't sell their grain for what it costs to plant it. Banks have to foreclose on loans. Small businesses, including the Humphrey family's drugstores, can't be paid in cash. And Humphrey's family goes from being the most prosperous or one of the most prosperous families in its own little town to losing their home, losing their drugstore. And in a way, it makes Hubert Humphrey a New Dealer before there's a New Deal, because what he takes out of this is a realization that you need activist government to address the needs of people in economic crisis. You can't just say to them on one hand, if you're in economic trouble, it must be a bad decision you make or your sinfulness. And you can't say, if you need help, go to the church for a handout. And that really prepares Humphrey, before FDR is even elected president, to support the whole New Deal agenda.
And he goes to LSU partly for financial reasons, right? It's that they gave him a leg up.
Right. Humphrey had to drop out of college for 5 years to help his family survive the Great Depression. And so he doesn't return and get his bachelor's degree till age 28. And by that time, he's married, he's the father of an infant daughter, and in going to grad school, he needs to be able to pay for it, and LSU gives him $400 to be a teaching assistant. And in 2023 dollars, that's $8,500. That's a substantial amount of money. And that's the one and only reason he goes to LSU.
And the fact that he's there and having to go through a Black neighborhood every day, you said was seminal. That's going through Baton Rouge, or particularly
in Baton Rouge. Well, what's amazing about his year at Baton Rouge is it sensitizes Humphrey to Black experience, but also Jewish experience, which you wouldn't expect would come out of the Deep South. And just you have to understand, Humphrey had a great mind. He could synthesize information. He had a bear trap memory. We all know he was eloquent, even if he sometimes orated too long to a fault.
He gave a great speech.
Although his wife Muriel once said, Hubert, in order to be immortal, a speech need not be eternal. But he needed to feel politics in his gut and in his heart before his brain could engage. It was visceral and personal to him. And at LSU, he is immersed in a Jim Crow society for the first time, and it just offends his basic sense of morality. But he also makes his first Jewish friend in his life, a guy in the debate team, Alvin Rubin, who would later become a federal judge. And Alvin Rubin talks to Humphrey about his five uncles trapped in Lithuania who will all be exterminated during the war by the Nazis. And that's the beginning of Humphrey being really deeply sensitized to the Jewish experience, not only in Europe, but in the United States as well. And to top it all off, Humphrey studies that whole year in a small seminar taught by an exiled, anti-Nazi, part Jewish professor named Rudolf Eberle. And Eberle talks to Humphrey explicitly about the way he feels that the treatment of Jews in Germany maps exactly onto the treatment of Blacks in the Jim Crow South. And so when Humphrey returns to Minneapolis at the end of this—
Before we leave Eberle, I just would love you to share the quote that he gave his students when he talked about—
Yeah, Humphrey recalled this even 40 years later, writing to Eberle on the occasion of Eberle's 80th birthday.
Wow.
Eberle casts his gaze across the seminar room at the dozen students and says, if we were in Germany, maybe two of you would resist the Nazis. And I think Humphrey took that as a mission statement. It was, I think, a real important lesson for him in don't be complacent. Don't think that you can ride the tiger, because the tiger will ride you. Take the stand even when it's dangerous, if it's the righteous stand.
Can you talk a little bit more about anti-Semitism in those years and what was percolating around him? And this is before he becomes mayor.
Sure. Well, first of all, nationally, in the late 30s and very early 40s, before Pearl Harbor takes America into the war, there's a massive support for isolationism in this country, which has a strong anti-Semitic element. Just to cite one of many examples, Charles Lindbergh, the aviation hero, is probably the most prominent and treacherous spokesman for isolationism. And he gives this notorious speech in Des Moines, Iowa, in which he says the only three factions in the world that want America to enter what he called Europe's war are the British, the bankers, and the Jews. And of course, as far as Lindbergh was concerned, the bankers and the Jews were one and the same anyway. So that attitude was out there. And in Minneapolis specifically, that had been a hotbed of support for a pro-Nazi group called the Silver Shirts, who regularly met in Minneapolis. It was a place with a great deal of support for Gerald L.K. Smith, a right-wing minister who headed the America First political party. And the Silver Shirts and Gerald L.K. Smith had the advocacy, incredibly, of one of Minnesota's own U.S. senators, Ernest Lundeen, who we now know was having speeches written for him by a Nazi agent, incredibly enough. And even after Lundeen dies in a plane crash, his widow becomes the great advocate in Minneapolis for these groups. So, you know, everyone should forget anything they think they know about blue Minneapolis or about the idea of Minnesota nice. That
we think of Amy Klobuchar.
And Amy Klobuchar is like the living legacy of Hubert Humphrey right now, I think. Her and Cory Booker are the two best exemplars of Humphrey on today's scene. But from the turn of the 20th century, when Jewish and black populations begin to build up numbers in Minneapolis, up through 1945 when Humphrey's elected mayor, Minneapolis is fiercely, entrenchedly racist and anti-Semitic. This sounds almost like a joke, but just to give you one example, Jews couldn't even belong to AAA in Minneapolis. I read of a case in which a rabbi applied to AAA for membership, thinking they at least will accept me, and he got a letter back saying, why don't you go to St. Paul? Wow. St. Paul, right next door, was a majority Catholic city that was much more tolerant of Jews and blacks as part of a political coalition. Minneapolis was a WASP city. And they had such a majority, they felt they could just beat down on everyone else, and they did beat down on everyone else. Another example of just the entrenched Jew hatred in Minneapolis is that the University of Minnesota, while trying to project outward the idea that we're this great liberal research institution, their dean of students, and here I must credit the great Jewish studies scholar Revellyn Prell for revealing this in her research, the dean of students would keep a census of black and Jewish students in the 1930s. And he would report their names to right-wing political operatives. The assumption was every Jewish student must be a Bolshevik. And this information was used to smear people in their political or public lives. So imagine the secret census of Jewish students.
It doesn't necessarily track that it would be politically fortuitous for him to focus on anti-Semitism and civil rights in Minnesota. How did he become mayor?
I think you're totally right, Abby, that maybe if he'd run any other time before, other than 1945, and in fact he'd run and lost in 1943, not emphasizing civil rights, but 1945 is this moment. He's running in the spring and early summer, right after VE Day, right after the newsreels of the death camps are being shown in movie houses, including in Minneapolis, right after the first English language articles by American reporters are being published about the Holocaust. And I think there's a moment of reckoning in this country about what are we going to do about hatred on the home front. And it's even underscored by a lot of the pop culture of this time. You know, Frank Sinatra makes a short film at this time called The House I Live In, in which the film is about a gang, a WASP youth gang, surrounding and about to beat up a Jewish kid. And Frank Sinatra interrupts the incipient beating when he takes a cigarette break from his recording studio and steps into this alley. And Sinatra talks them language we wouldn't hear in a movie with kids now. He says, you're behaving like a bunch of Nazis.
Wow.
And then he breaks into the song, The House I Live In, written by the same lyricist who wrote Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday's anti-lynching anthem. And in The House I Live In, one of the lyrics is, all races and religions That's America to me. So this is a radical reframing of who gets to belong. And I think Humphrey capitalized on that moment. And
but there was some peril even to his life. Can you talk about the time he was almost assassinated?
Absolutely. And I think almost no one knows this story about Humphrey. You know, standing up for blacks and Jews in 1940s America, even in light of that awakening I was talking about just a moment ago, carried a lot of risk to it. And Humphrey, at the time as mayor, he's moving forward on the civil rights and human rights agenda. He's making the city do a study of its own history of and practices of bigotry. Is coming home from the rubber chicken circuit late one night, and outside his house, three bullets whiz by his head. And this was an assassination attempt by a white supremacist who was tied in with white supremacist and anti-Semitic groups around the country, who was a follower of Gerald L.K. Smith, whom I mentioned earlier, and who, when he was arrested, had, among other things, what else would a neo-Nazi have but a German Luger gun, as well as knives, propaganda materials, a map of World War III. And the incredible thing is that Humphrey is not dissuaded at all. The morning after this assassination attempt, Humphrey's son Skip comes down the stairs to go to school, and he sees in the living room a cop sitting in the chair with a sawed-off shotgun across his lap. That's how serious this was. And Humphrey says nothing of it, keeps it out of the paper for 6 weeks, and just proceeds to move forward on civil rights and human rights as if this had never happened. So people who thought he was this corny guy, this kind of weakling, have him totally wrong.
You've called him a congenital optimist, that he practiced the politics of joy. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, the politics of joy was his term, and he also adopted the wonderful moniker of Al Smith, the happy warrior. And he was an enthusiast, and he was ebullient, and he was positive about America while looking squarely at America's fault. So I think one reason he was so successful is his critique was always a loving critique. His appeal was for America to live up to its best intentions. He didn't see America as intrinsically morally deformed and incapable of redemption. And I think in that respect, that's why he often talked about the social justice prophets. There's a great speech I found of his, almost like a Devar Torah, except it's not the Parsha he happens to talk about, but he's talking to a Jewish congregation in Minneapolis in the mid-40s, and he cites, you know, Amos and Hosea and Jeremiah, and is talking about their passion and their desire to make noise, not to be quiet about injustice. So again, for him, the religious basis of idealism was vital.
What about him personally? Did you get to like him? What was he like as a family man, as a husband, as a dad? Any sense of that?
I got a lot of sense of that. I became very admiring and fond of him, not exculpatory. I think he deserved the slings and arrows his reputation took over Vietnam, for instance. But he was someone who really had a moral core combined with great practical political skills. He was a complete, genuine people person. He, in his marriage and in his relationship with his amazing sister Frances and with other political people, was way ahead of his time on gender equality. He really listened, you know, closely to females around him for their political advice and relied on them in significant ways, not just to be kind of arm candy or to do scut work. And yet, you know, at the same time, he was politically ambitious. When he was mayor, he was out every night, you know, giving speeches or reading all the mail that came into his office. He would get home 10, 11 at night. His kids were in bed. Muriel then would start to talk politics with him, his wife Muriel, at 10 or 11 at night. And there's no question that he also benefited from the gender inequality of the time, in the sense that he could depend on this amazing woman, you know, Muriel Buck Humphrey, to take care of all the domestic labor while he was out doing all the political labor.
So I want to spend some time on his 1948 speech, because I don't remember it being such a kind of a turning point, but you really make the case that it was. And when I went back to YouTube to listen to it, just 10 minutes, I mean,
right,
it's amazing how something can land with that little time. It should be a lesson for all rabbis giving sermons. But can you just give us the sense of the run-up to that speech?
Sure.
He wasn't necessarily going to give it, or
right,
have time, be given a slot.
Well, right, the 1948 convention for the Democrats. It's understood Harry Truman will get renominated. In fact, most people in the party expect he's going to lose to Tom Dewey. So the battle at that convention is whether the Democrats will have a civil rights plank in their platform for the first time ever. Because Franklin Roosevelt, in spite of all the great things he did as president, among his failings was he never took a stand on civil rights because he wanted the votes of the Southern segregationist wing of the party. And at the convention, this battle is going to boil over. And I want to add here that the plank that Humphrey sold with this great speech to the convention made its guarantees against discrimination effective not only on the basis of race, but also religion and national origin. So this was a landmark policy plank, not only for Black Americans, but for Jewish Americans, for Catholic Americans, for Japanese and Chinese Americans, Mexican Americans, just about every national religious minority group at that time benefited.
And people advised him against giving it.
Well, he was threatened not to give it. Harry Truman, even though he'd gone back and forth on civil rights, at times being bold and at times retreating, was in retreat at this moment, wanted to do the FDR playbook of appease the Southerners. And one of Truman's point people at the convention tells Humphrey, if you give this speech, your political career is over. And keep in mind, Humphrey's a kid. He's 37 years old. He's been the mayor of a mid-sized city for 3 years. So they could squash him like a bug if they choose to. So it's, you know, incredibly risky of him to give this speech.
So let's talk about two of the most famous lines. He says, to those who say that we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say we are 172 years late.
That goes back, if you do the math, to 1776. That's why that line is there.
Amazing. Can you just give us a little color? We're running out of time, but just...
Humphrey had been trying out this line, and I know the other one, I'll let you read it, in previous speeches. You know, like in the I Have a Dream speech, Martin Luther King had done that dream analogy in another speech months earlier. And Mahalia Jackson, the gospel singer and civil rights activist, heard it in Detroit months earlier. And you can hear her, if you listen to the recording from the March on Washington, she's saying, Martin, tell him about the dream. She's like the opera prompter.
She's like, do it again.
Do it again. He'd been trying it out. And Humphrey, in some radio addresses, in some speeches at committee hearings during the 48 convention, kept on trying to get these phrases exactly right. And didn't always. Sometimes he had the math wrong. He would say, like, you know, 179 years or something mistaken. But this time he nailed it because he had practiced it.
And then the line that is obviously the inspiration for your title. The time has arrived, he said, to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights.
Well, you have to think of what this meant to Humphrey. Number one, he knew the 23rd Psalm. When he's using this phrase, he's thinking about walking through the shadow of the valley of death. Mm-hmm. Number two, he had experienced devastating dust storms during the 30s, the dirty 30s, as they called them in South Dakota. He understood what it was like when the sun is blotted out and it's midnight in the middle of the day. He said that he felt like it was the end of the world. And he also knew what it was like to see the sun miraculously come back. So I think this interplay of shadow and sunlight also speaks to a very primal experience of his.
And states' rights was a euphemism, in a sense, just for those of us who don't use those terms today.
Right. States' rights was the Southerners' idea that if the Constitution doesn't explicitly say a state must do X, Y, or Z, in this case, have racial equality, then every state can make up its own mind. So it's a state's right to say we want to have, you know, a Jim Crow apartheid state. The federal government has nothing to say on this subject. And that was their rationalization for their system of segregation.
So I want to end with the end of his life, which is actually the beginning of your book and the prologue. It's a beautiful beginning. And I should say that the New York Times called this book brilliant. So not my words, but the reviewer. But it's a very kind of sad ending to see him in that podium, depleted by cancer, which sounds like it ravaged him. Mm-hmm. And again, his reputation is certainly tarnished, to say the least. How do you describe his ending? And do you think he had any sense that his legacy might be burnished by Sam Friedman?
I'm sure he did not. I grew up in a family of parents who were Gene McCarthy voters who opposed Humphrey in 68, although they definitely voted for him against Nixon. I think he worried about his legacy a lot. He was someone who, as I said before, was genuinely ebullient and optimistic most of the time. But between knowing he was going to die very young, age 66, and knowing that he had become this object of kind of contempt and scorn by people who'd been his most ardent followers, when he's writing letters and giving speeches at the end of his life, they're filled with this kind of poignant, understated sorrow about what he hasn't accomplished or how hard on him political life has been. Mm.
Samuel Friedman, it's a wonderful book, and the name of it, I'm going to repeat now, Into the Bright Sunshine, Young Hubert Humphrey and the Fight for Civil Rights. I'm Abigail Pogrebin. Thank you for being with us, and I'll see you next time on In the Spotlight.